You're listening to KDNK's Public Affairs Program for Land's Sake. I'm Bill Kite, your host. And today our guest is Steven Berger. I knew I was going to do this with your name. Steven, help me out here. Bergeny, right?
Correct.
Okay. And welcome to the show, Steven. We've finally been able to get you on the show, and it helps when I turn the mic on. To get you on the show finally, and now you're here, so I guess we better get with it.
All right. We'll do that.
And last time we saw each other was night before last, wasn't it?
That's correct.
We went to the Voices where you spoke. As a matter of fact, if you want to see what Steven was talking about, you can look in the current issue of Soper Sun. And he's part of the Voices that were done there by Aspen Valley Land Trust. And even though we didn't finish the program, we got most of the people done and got home thanks to you. And we rode our bikes there, and Steven gave us a ride back. So thanks for doing that.
No worries.
Well, people don't know you that are listening. A lot of people don't. So tell us a little bit about the fact that you were a two-term member of the Glenwood Springs City Council. You're a blacksmith, currently drive a school bus for Ross Montessori School. What else would you like the folks to know about you?
Well, I come from a family that raised cattle in the valley for almost 100 years. We were fortunate enough to be able to have a very wonderful ranch on 4 Mile on the Dry Park Road. And it was a great way to grow up. It caused me or allowed me to create a huge connection to the land. You can't raise animals and do those kinds of things without having the land work its magic on you, and you begin to learn how to work in concert with the land in order to help it provide the most it can for the benefit of your animals and for you. And we always had a big garden. My grandfather, Bergeny, always grew a huge plot of cucumbers because pickles were a mainstay in the family, and as was sauerkraut, which he and my grandmother would make sauerkraut every year. So it was a great way to grow up.
Yeah, my family, we used to do pickling and a lot of other canning too, just preparing for the winter.
Absolutely.
I miss that. Not much of it's done anymore.
No, it's
really not. So tell us a little bit about your pioneer family. How you're related to.
Well, on my mother's side, my family came to the valley in 1880. My great-great-grandmother, a woman named Ellen O'Kane, brought her six children after she was widowed in Leadville, brought her six children and moved to Aspen. And my great-grandfather, George Frost, married one of Ellen's daughters, Mary O'Kane. And he and his brother Paul had a freighting company in Aspen, and they hauled silver ore with wagons and teams of horses from Aspen to Leadville to the stamping mills, and they hauled ore year round.
Wow!
So they were pretty tough characters.
Yeah, definitely over the Independence Pass.
Over the pass. Yeah.
Wow, that would be rough in a wagon.
It was.
I can imagine.
So that's my mother's side of the family. And my father's side of the family, my grandfather, Bergeny, came with his family in 1903 from an area halfway between Vienna and Budapest, an area known as Regensburg. And it was a little village by the name of Altodis. Uh-huh. And so the reason for him, the primary motivation for him to come was that he had been conscripted into either the Hungarian or the Austrian army six times.
Wow.
And he knew he wasn't going to live to be an old man if it kept up, but they would have a border skirmish and the border would change and he'd be in the Austrian army, and then they'd have a skirmish and the border would change and he'd be conscripted into the Hungarian army. So it just went back and forth like that. I think I said Regensburg, I meant Burgenland was the name of this area.
Okay.
So it was a really mixing pot. My family on that side spoke a dialect of German. that was really a mixture of German and Serbian and Croatian. And so the language there was just a reflection of the polyglot of different cultures that had come together there and intermixed. So it was interesting.
I see now where the sauerkraut comes from. Absolutely. Wanting to make sauerkraut. Actually, sauerkraut and kimchi are really good for your health. Probiotic.
One of the interesting little side stories that might interest people, just to illustrate how small the world has always been. My grandfather served his stonemasonry apprenticeship on a building in Budapest that was known later as the New York Cafe, that was designed by an architect by the name of Theodor von Rosenberg.
Ah, Theodor von Rosenberg.
So, okay. Theodor von Rosenberg was hired by Walter Devereux to design the bathhouse and the train depot for Glenwood Springs.
Yep.
And when my grandfather stepped off the train in 1903, von Rosenberg was on the platform at the train depot, and they were in the process of trying to finish the depot, and he recognized my grandfather and went with my grandfather out to George Hamrick's ranch, where my grandfather was going to work, to ask if he could make use of my grandfather's stonemasonry skills to help finish the train depot.
Oh, that's amazing.
And George agreed, and so he had a hand in helping finish the depot. So
remind me when we're done to tell you a story about the von Rosenberg family, because that's even neater to know the fact that he worked on the train depot.
Yes.
What are some of the things that you and the city council did while you were a councilman that you're proud of, and conversely, what are some of the things you feel were left undone?
Well, we had a very busy time in the 8 years that I served. I started April of 2009 and served for two consecutive four-year terms. We got a lot done. We were able to do some things that the city really needed. We built a new parking structure at 9th and Cooper. We provided the land and a swap with the library to keep the library in town. And so we provided the land at 8th and Cooper, where the new library sits, in exchange for the old library building, which now houses the youth zone.
Right.
We had one incredibly major project, of course, and that was the replacement of the bridge. And that consumed a lot of our time and a lot of our energy. As you will remember, there was no little amount of controversy over the bridge, because people thought it was going to destroy the town. And unfortunately, when I was on council, I was the only person on council who had been to the ribbon cutting for the bridge we were replacing.
I'll be darned.
And I was 5 years old, and my dad took me down, and the whole town turned out to see that new bridge being commissioned.
Right.
And so it was a big day. But it was 63 years old, and it was a 50-year structure, so yep, it was well past its useful life, and it just had to be done. I like to think it was a good accomplishment. I like to think we did a good thing there. What troubles me about my city council time, when you talk about things that were undone or that we seemingly couldn't figure out how to do, housing is the one real issue.
Of course.
We're facing it in an even more exacerbated form now, because the pandemic freed people who were able to make a good living by working remotely to have the freedom to move to places like Carbondale and Glenwood, where they could recreate freely and had immediate access to things that were in their lifestyle. And so that put an incredible crunch on the available housing market and has really driven prices up. And so that's my biggest failure. Part of the problem you have with the city council form of government is that you don't have the ability to form a long view, an overarching set of principles that will carry you forward into the future, because each successive council can change it. And so it's a very, at times, a very frustrating thing to try to develop the kind of resolve and the kind of vision it takes to really tackle a problem like affordable housing.
And last month we had on Gail Swartz, who's the president there of the Marin Fort chapter of the Habitat for Humanity, about some really good ways of trying to deal with that housing situation.
They're working very hard to do that, and I applaud them.
You're listening to Katie and Kay's For Land's Sake program. Today our guest is Stephen Bergenick, and we're going to ask him what inspired him to become a blacksmith. And those of you that don't know, he is a blacksmith. Tell us a little bit about that, will you?
Well, it's just kind of, I came back from my time in Alaska, which I spent 5 years in the bush, freezing fish. When I returned from Alaska the last time, I had to find something to make a living, so I started out working for a local plumber here, and then when that came to an end, I mean, I got to the point where I was not able to do it as well as I'd like to do. I had to look for something that was a little easier than crawling around in crawl spaces.
For sure.
And so I stepped off the end of the earth and started doing blacksmithing. I had done some blacksmithing as a kid on the ranch, because we had a full blacksmith shop, because the original owner of the ranch, whom we purchased it from, George Hamrick, the same man that my grandfather came to work for, he raised draft horses for all the to sale for all the farmers around. And so he had a fully appointed blacksmith shop. And so I got an early acquaintance to the blacksmithing through my father. And we spent some wonderful hours heating iron and pounding iron and making things. So in 2004, I stepped off the end of the earth and started blacksmithing in earnest. And I was very fortunate. I was I made some artifacts that I submitted, and they were accepted, and I was allowed to become a member of the Saturday Market in Aspen, which I did for about 6 or 7 years. And then I've just done, since then, mostly commissions and the kinds of art pieces that I wanted to do. I specialize in certain things. I like to do lots of things that are useful and utilitarian in the house. And I don't do any architectural work with the exception of gates. I like to build gates. And so I've built several gates for people and some fence. But I don't really do – I do some yard art. And I like to do things that are recycled. So I take found objects and turn them into things of beauty if I can.
Oh, great, great. Tell us, if you would, the name of your ranch, and I saw pictures of it. It's a beautiful location. Just a little background about that, and then we can discuss what you think about some of the land issues as a landowner.
Well, our land, our ranch was known as the Lazy V Quarter Circle. It was situated, the home place was situated where Spring Ridge Subdivision is now, both Spring Ridge 1 and Spring Ridge Reserve. That was our home base. And then we owned about 1,600 acres. We owned about 800 acres there, and we owned about 1,600 acres of summer rangeland up on the east flank of Sunlight Peak. When we sold the ranch in 1990, we had already sold 800 acres of summer range situated directly west of Oak Meadows to AMAX Corporation, which they traded to the U.S. Forest Service in exchange for a like amount of acreage at Mount Emmons in Crested Butte, because they were at that time thinking they were going to open a new molybdenum mine, which thankfully never took place.
Right.
So we also own this 662-acre parcel that contains the site of the old Black Diamond coal mine and wraps up over the hill to Three Mile Creek and extends north to Hughes Reservoir. And so that became a piece of property that was still in the family, and we as a family over a course of time began to have a conversation about trying to preserve it, which luckily everyone agreed. There are seven of us, and we all agree, and that's pretty unusual.
It is, I would say.
But we have all been of one mind about it, and so it's permanently preserved and will always be the way it is.
It's with Aspen Valley Land Trust,
it's
correct?
It's with Aspen Valley Land Trust, yes. And I have I was approached by the executive director, Suzanne Stevens, 3 years ago to see if I would be willing to serve on the board, which I was more than happy to do so. I'm at the end of my first three-year term. We usually serve 2 3-year terms, and so I'm serving this year as the secretary of the board of directors, and we're doing tremendous work. And through the efforts of people like Perry Will in the state Senate, availability of funds through tax credit for conserving your property has taken a huge leap upwards. It's made it possible for a lot of families who otherwise couldn't see their way clear to putting the conservation easement on their property because they wouldn't realize enough return to be able to manage the property, now have the opportunity to do that. And it's made a world of difference in the number of people who are coming to us wanting to preserve their properties.
Right. And that, and one of the piece of properties that we were at Saturday night was Kaufman Ranch.
Yeah,
and
correct.
And they had the memorial service there, I guess, Saturday for Rex, did you not?
Yes, yeah. Yes, we did.
That's just a wonderful purchase. I'm really glad that AVLT got to purchase that.
We're delighted. Rex and Joe, again, with their family, had a conversation, and they decided that what they wanted was for it to be conserved, and they wanted it to be, if what they really wanted was for Aspen Valley Land Trust to own it.
Right.
And we were lucky enough to be able to effect that purchase. Our master plan is that ultimately it will also be the permanent home and headquarters for Aspen Valley Land Trust.
Right.
And it's a beautiful 147-acre property that is going to be really a showcase and a place for the community to enjoy, and we hope that people who hear this will think about going and taking a tour at Kaufman Ranch, because it has almost a mile of riverfront. It has riparian areas. It's a beautiful landscape. There's wildlife. There are myriad wildflowers. It's a beautiful, beautiful place.
It really is. I was glad I got to be there the other day on Saturday. As a landowner, what are some of the concerns you have that you see are threats to the land and that you have issues with that are forefront of your mind?
Well, we have to recognize at some point that there are certain things that are more valuable than filling a space with development. And one of the things that conserving land and making open space available is that it will preserve the ability of our children and grandchildren and great-grandchildren to still be able to view wildlife, to be able to take advantage of clear, beautiful, pristine waterways,
right,
to have the ability to just be in nature in the way that nature should be enjoyed. And that's a huge thing. The other big concern is that there has been a real lack in my mind, and this is just me, but I feel there's been a huge lack of foresight at the county level with regard to open space. And I'm hoping we can have that conversation with the county commissioners to convince them that eating up the valley floor endlessly with increased development is jeopardizing a lot of the very things that attract people to come here in the very first place.
That's true. What people come here for a lot of times, to get away from, they bring with them too. So
correct,
because they're not really conscious of the way we live here in the West.
Correct.
But I appreciate those comments. As a fellow storyteller, you told a really good story the other night, and as I said, it's in this issue of the Soper Sun. What prompted you to become a storyteller?
You know, that's an outgrowth of sitting around the campfire ring in our camp along Three Mile Creek. My brother and I, this summer was pretty typical. We camped for 3 days every other week all summer long.
Wow.
And so those evenings spent talking with each other and relating things that had happened to us or things that we believe in and are concerned about really lends itself to the art of storytelling. And I've always been interested in the history of the area and in the history of my family on both sides. And so we share those stories and it just is something I guess I grew up doing.
Right.
You know, yeah. It comes naturally to me, and I do enjoy letting other people know what I know. I guess I'm a frustrated teacher, but it's interesting to share those things with people and have them take part in that whole experience. Plus, the other part of it for me is I really am very fond of looking someone in the eye, face to face, and having a conversation. That to me supplants all of the social media stuff, because it's how I grew up. It's how we grew up. It's what you did. You had conversations.
Dialogue. It just seems to be missing with people. They just want to cram what they believe down your throat.
Well, because of social media and things like texting, you are one step removed from that human interaction.
Exactly.
You know. One of the best cartoons I ever saw about that issue was two young people, a boy and a girl, sitting on a park bench, obviously in love, texting each other. And so that's kind of the what's been lost is that human spark, that touch, that contact.
And to be a storyteller, I think, too, you have to listen. And so many people nowadays don't listen to that. In that dialogue, it doesn't become a dialogue then if you don't listen.
And strangely enough, that's one of the things being in the landscape does for you. If you're in the landscape long enough, you learn how to listen. Because
Yep, for sure.
The forest has its own voices. And sometimes it even is important to listen carefully in the forest because of the dangers that are there. So you learn how to take in what the natural world offers you and process it, and you do that by listening very carefully.
True, isn't that true? Tell us a little bit about how you became involved with voices in the storytelling you did there the other night.
It was just Anjanette Garcia, who is the community outreach person for Aspen Valley Land Trust, asked me if I would be willing to tell a story, and I agreed, and so I met Cassidy Wiley, who is the community outreach and program director for Voices, and so that was how it came about. And I was I was not sure what I was going to do, but I was sitting thinking about it, and I called my best friend from high school to have him have a conversation with him to refresh my memory about this incident that I related, which was a seminal incident and a seminal occurrence for me in terms of how I viewed what should be done with the property that we owned.
Great, Jan. If you want to know the rest of the story, then just grab a soap or sun. In the last 2 minutes we have here, Stephen, can you tell us a little bit about what legacy would you like to leave in the world?
Well, I think part of the legacy that I would like to leave I have already done, and that was to really conserve this piece of property. It is a very complex, very, very beautiful piece of property. And when we decided to conserve it, Jonathan Lowski from Basalt did the baseline study for it, and he indicated to Aspen Valley Land Trust that it was the finest single piece of property they had ever conserved.
Wow.
And so that says a lot about it. And that's part of my legacy. The other part of my legacy is that I hope that I have contributed to my community and in a good way, and left some landmarks behind that people use and are beneficial to people, like the parking structure in Glenwood and the new bridge and those kinds of things. So, and the other single thing of all is just for everyone who knows me to know who I am, and especially my family, because we share so much love and we have such a tight circle that it's just an incredible thing to be a part of.
I think that sounds like a very good legacy to leave from my viewpoint. If people want to get involved with Aspen Valley Land Trust, what should they do?
It's very easy. They have a website, avlt.org, and they can get on the website, or they can come to 320 Main Street, Suite 200, and speak with the staff. It's very easy to do.
Well, thank you so much, Stephen, for being with us. I really appreciate it. And if you want to listen to more For Land's Sake, tune in the second Monday of every month at 4:30 right here on KDNK.